SETI says it's quite possible that by the year 2025, they will find conclusive evidence of a civilization light years from our home. Fascinating. Let's take some calls with you and Seth when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Seth, so 2025, is that a target date? How'd they get to that?
Well, George, that's a number that I came up with, and not everybody agrees with it, but it's based on the fact that with this Allen telescope array, if we get it up and running with a few more telescopes, then by 2025, just with a straightforward projection of digital technology, we should be able to check out on the order of a million star systems. And I think that that's the right number to get a hit. And so I'm modestly optimistic that by 2025 we'll know.
History Channel is running this week Ancient Aliens, a documentary on the possibilities. And one of the theories, of course, Eric von Däniken's Chariot of the Gods, that aliens visited planet Earth here tens of thousands of years ago, helped our ancestors build things, like the pyramids, Nazca lines in Peru. You, of course, don't believe that. But what about the possibilities it could be true?
Well, to begin with, I think von Däniken was talking about, very, very early visits, like 60,000 years ago. Keep in mind that the Nazca lines are like 1,000 years
right.
old. So, they're not very old at all. And, and the pyramids, they're somewhat older. They're like 4,000 or 5,000
years. Or maybe 10 at the outset, as some think.
Well, yes. Okay, we won't get into that.
Another debate. I'll bring Graham Hancock in.
Okay. All right. But even 10, it really doesn't matter. The thing is this, I've been to the pyramids a couple of times. I don't know, maybe you've been there.
No, I haven't. Not yet.
Well, if you go there, you take a look at them, and you see, what's involved in building the pyramids? You got to cut up some limestone and stack up these blocks on top of one another until you get a really big, pointy building. Okay. Well, these guys could do that. It actually isn't so hard, and they made a whole bunch of errors in the first couple of ones they built, which suggests that they didn't really know how to do it at first. It took them a couple of tries before they got a pyramid to actually work. That, to me, does not suggest that they had experts come in. If you found a cell phone inside one of those pyramids, you'd have me convinced. But, do people say, hey, the Parthenon there in Athens? Man, those Greeks couldn't have built that 2,500 years ago. It must have been aliens who put it together, right? Or what about the Colosseum in Rome? That's a little younger, but it's almost 2,000 years old. Well, I don't think those Romans could have built that. You wouldn't buy that. But somehow, with the Egyptians, maybe because they're in the wrong part of the world, they needed alien help to build pointy buildings. I don't think so. I think they could do it.
All right, let's go to the phone, Seth. We'll pick it up by going to Crestline, California. First-time caller, Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Sure thing.
George, this is Brian. I ran your jib cam on your into the or the unexplained.
Oh, that's right. Hey, good to see. Hey, you know what? They may make a decision on that pretty soon, by the way.
Well, I sure hope so, because ladies and gentlemen out there, George is one of the nicest guys you could ever work with. A professional out there in the broadcast industry. But the reason I called, I'm very interested in your guest and his endeavor, Seth. Good evening to you. The question I had for you is, I was curious, radio receivers have, particular sensitivity levels, and I'm sure yours is probably somewhere between outstanding and miraculous. Assuming that you have point sources, even within, say, a local group of stars, say, from here to 50 light years out, what do you anticipate the strength of a radio source, even at those relatively close distances, when you consider our own galaxy? Do you really anticipate that your receivers are sensitive enough to capture signals even within the local group? Or I guess what I'm trying to say is, what do you estimate the signal strength of a signal traveling, say, anywhere from 5 to 50 light years out, given inverse square, law, is this stuff really just below the ambient noise level, or do you think you can really capture such a thing?
Yeah. Well, Brian, that's been worked out. It's not such a hard calculation. It turns out, let me give, I could give you a number here, radio astronomers typically measure the strength of a signal in terms of Jansky's, that's a unit, and that's 10 to the minus 26 watts per square meter per hertz. Well, for most listeners, that isn't going to mean a whole lot, but let me just put it this way. If you had an antenna that was as big as the one down in Puerto Rico, the Arecibo antenna, that's 1,000 feet across, and you were on a planet 100 light years away, which is pretty far. It's farther than what you're talking about. 100 light years away, that's 600 trillion miles, so that's a long distance. You aimed it at us, and we had our SETI receivers at this end. We could hear you if your transmitter power was like 10,000 watts. Well, that's an AM broadcast station. That isn't a whole heck of a lot of power. So the answer to your question is, it doesn't take a lot of power if you have an antenna to direct it to produce a signal that you can pick up with the kind of technology we have today. That's the whole point of SETI. We can do it. Even 100 years after Marconi, we can do it. And if we can do it, well, they presumably can do it too.
I see. Well, you know, I hope you catch it, man.
I do too, Brian. Hey, thanks. Keep in touch, Brian.
You got it, George. Good night.
Okay. When was the last time you were in Arecibo, Seth?
Well, we haven't been in Arecibo for like 4 or 5 years, something like that. You know, ever since we started on the Allen Telescope Array.
Even before that, though, you were there, let's say, 12 years ago, 1997?
We were there in 97, 98.
Because 97, I called you on my St. Louis show, and you were down there.
That's right.
Remember?
Yep, we would go there twice a year.
Yep.
Yeah.
12 years ago already.
Yeah. Art Bell would occasionally call us down there, too. And it was kind of fun. We would set up a little webcam, and he would put it on his site.
That's cool. Let's go to Dan in Louisville, Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Hi, Dan. You're on with Seth.
Hello, Dr. Soshak, Shostak, and Mr. Norrie.
Hi.
I am a person who is just sort of curious about what kind of signal analysis you conducted on your waveforms that you received, and whether you perhaps examined, measured the entropy of it using something like, say, the ZIF function, which is used on examining the human genome in an off and on pattern according to adenine and guanine and cytosine and thymine base pairs, or if you did something along the lines of potentially examining amplitude changes or maybe even phase shift, or the possibility that maybe the signals that you're transmitting reflect more of their neurology, which would be less sequential, and the possibility that you might have parallel processing going on, where one might have to do the nearly impossible task of examining multiple frequencies at once and determining whether there's an absence or a presence of entropy in those patterns.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be incredibly complex. Just the task. I just wondered what kind of ropes you ran these signals through.
Right. Well, Dan, that's another technical question. We're getting a lot of technical questions here.
The scientists are coming out.
Yeah,
tonight,
exactly.
Huh?
We got a bunch of radio engineers out there.
They're good.
Dan, actually, what we do is a heck of a lot simpler than any of that. Because look, what we're trying to do in the first instance is simply find out that the on the air light is lit, that their transmitters are fired up. So we're not looking for any complicated messages or what you would call modulation. We're not doing any of that. We're just looking for, actually, we're looking for something very simple. We're looking for what are called narrowband signals. And all that means is that a lot of the transmitter power is at one spot on the radio dial, just like this broadcast, right? I mean, you can tune the radio dial, and most of it you're not going to hear coast to coast. But if you tune near the station's transmitting frequency, then you hear a squeal and, you know, a lot of energy in a small part of the dial. We don't worry about how they may be encoding their message. That's for the future. If you find that they're on the air, then you go build a much bigger thing and you go back and see if you can find a message. So in the first instance, we just look for narrowband signals, and that's relatively a straightforward processing task. I'll say one more thing. If they're using spread spectrum technology, a lot of people know what that is. Your cell phone works that way. Then it becomes much harder to find their signal, and so we're working on that problem. But it's very straightforward. We're not looking for the value of pi or anything like that. We're just trying to find out, do they have the transmitter switch on? That's it.
Seth, where are the offices for SETI?
Well, the SETI Institute is located here in lovely, glamorous Mountain View, California, which is in the Silicon Valley.
Yep.
So just south of San Francisco, about a 45-minute drive. The telescopes, of course, couldn't be situated here, although that would be very convenient. But, you know, this is a heavily populated area, so, you know, you'd have so much interference, you really couldn't use them. So they're up just north of Mount Lassen in California, about 30 miles north of Mount Lassen, in a little town called Hat Creek, which is famous mostly for trout fishing. But it's a beautiful area, but it's, you know, the mountains kind of shield the antennas from all the interference you would get from San Francisco and so forth. So it's a relatively quiet place.
Let's go to Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Audrey, you're up with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Hi, I'm great. My question is regarding the Drake equation.
Okay.
Because when looking at it, the value of L, the estimated lifetime of possible advanced civilizations, interests me the most. Because if I were to base my estimate off my experience on Earth, looking at our species, I would have a conservative estimate because it seems as though our primal instincts have dominated our cognitive reasoning, and I tend to be discouraged by that. So my question is, Seth, do you think many advanced civilizations survive their technological adolescence, and what is your estimate of the value of L?
Yeah. Well, Audrey, Audrey, of course, is getting at the question of, well, you know, you might have a lot of societies that get started, and then they invent radio, so they become interesting for SETI, and then 50 years after they invent radio, they invent the H-bomb, and 50 years after that, they go off the air in a mushroom cloud, okay? And, you know, you're asking me whether that happens a lot, but of course I don't know, and one thing that SETI might be able to tell you is if we were to find some societies, you would say, well, they don't all blow themselves up because, look, we found this one. So that would be interesting. My personal view on this, Audrey, is that you do invent the H-bomb shortly after you invent radio, which sounds bad. But the other thing is you also invent rockets shortly after you invent radio because you need the rockets to carry the H-bombs around mostly. But the rockets give you the opportunity to move into space. And I think that, you know, within a couple of hundred years after inventing radio, you probably start spreading out through your own solar system, colonies on nearby planets or whatever. And if that happens a lot, then probably it gets very hard to wipe yourself out completely because, you know, you're all over the place. So call me Pollyanna, but I think that a lot of these societies will survive. But really, we don't know until we find them.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to Cleveland now. Texas, that is. First-time caller. Hello, Ed.
Hello, George and Seth.
Welcome to the show, Ed. Go ahead.
Yeah, Seth, what's the highest frequency you're watching on?
Well, the Allen Telescope Array actually can work up to more than 10 gigahertz. So that's 10,000 megahertz, which is, I guess that's about 10 million times higher than an AM station in terms of frequency. Yeah, pretty
okay.
High.
Okay. I would suggest, if you can, go to 0.000715, and that's the frequency of gravity. And you get between stars and planets. That's the fastest way to do it.
The frequency of gravity? What is the frequency of gravity? I got to ask you a question.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, 0.000715.
Well, I don't know. Ed, I'll pass that on.
Centimeters. And I would suggest looking at the Polaris system when you do it.
Well, Polaris is, you know, it's an easy one to look at because it's always up there. You can always see Polaris, at least in the northern hemisphere. It's the North Star. But I don't know if it has any planets. I don't think any have been found around Polaris.
Remarkable job. You must have fun, Seth, doing what you do.
Listen, if it didn't have fun, George, you know, I mean, who wants to do a job which isn't fun?
Do you travel a lot?
Yeah, too much, actually. Yes, I do a lot of traveling. I do.
And I'm also curious, how about young people? Are they interested in this?
They are. I actually gave a couple of talks this morning at a local high school. I don't talk so often at high schools, but I enjoy doing that because, with young people, you give them some of these ideas, and you might change a few of them. A few of them might go into science, might study astronomy. Who knows? You know, with older crowds, they might find it interesting, but 2 days later, they may have just, you know, they've gone back to whatever they were doing. And with young people, you can actually change a few lives. So I like talking to young people. And the other thing about young people is they're all very, very optimistic about all of this. If you ask an older crowd of people, you know, how many of you think aliens are out there? Well, 2/3 of their hands go up. But if you ask a school class, they all raise their hands. So, you know, they're a lot of fun.
Next up, let us go to east of the Rockies, Joanne in Long Island, New York.
Hi.
Hey.
First, I want to compliment you, George. You're the perfect replacement for Art Bell, and he was right. You really get it, and you're always courteous and respectful to your guests, and you let them say anything they want, and you let your callers disagree, which is what I'm about to do.
Okay, that's good.
Because I'm a regular listener to your show. And by the way, in 1965, I bought Walter Sullivan's book, We Are Not Alone, and I read it, and 62. But as I'm from the Stanton Friedman School of Thought, and
okay.
I read his latest book called UFOs and Science.
Sure.
Here's where I disagree. I think it would be totally primitive thinking on our part to think an advanced civilization is going to use something as primitive as radio waves, and they would have to be suicidal or stupid to just broadcast their location willy-nilly to just anyone in the universe, because then they might get the Klingons of the universe attacking them. So I don't think we should be broadcasting our location unless we knew who we were broadcasting to, because unfortunately we Earthlings are a primitive society because we hurt ourselves, and I don't think we're ready for big time. But anyways, as to airplane pilots, they do say they've seen alien spacecraft. Seth maybe chooses not to read books on this subject, or I don't know. He chooses to be a skeptic, but there's plenty of information. There's plenty of evidence for alien life right here in our airspace, and I rest my case.
All right, Lethbridge, you have the floor now, Mr.
Okay.
Sosak. Go ahead.
Well, they're very interesting points by Joanne.
Thank you.
Of course, I know Stanton.
Yes, you do.
Yes, and, you know, I would say this, Joanne. It is true that plenty of pilots have claimed to have seen things that they don't understand. I was down in San Diego, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, where they had a whole bunch of the Apollo astronauts, and I was talking with Edgar Mitchell, and he was, you know, confiding to me. He said, you know, the government knows about the aliens and this, that, and the other. Now, Edgar Mitchell has, you know, been on the moon. He's not, you know, he's somebody you're going to listen to. But I'll tell you, I think that if there really were good evidence to that, you could, you know, take the train into New York City, go to the American Museum of Natural History, the old Hayden Planetarium there, and you'd find an exhibit about it, and you can't. And I think that means a lot, actually, because that shows you the evidence is actually not very good. Eyewitness testimony is just not good enough. I mean, you know, everybody knows that. Anybody who's ever served on a jury knows that how unreliable eyewitness testimony is. It isn't that people haven't seen something, but they're not clear what they've seen. And to say that I, you know, don't want to read about this and so forth, I have to say that the book that you mentioned by Stan Friedman is actually on the end table next to my bed. So, in fact, it's not quite true that I don't read about it.
Did you enjoy it?
I do. I have to say, Stanton, you know, he tends to get into attack mode sometimes. So, you know, that's...
But he's a good guy. He's got a heart of gold, though, Seth. Nice guy.
Well, that is true. I can verify that. Yeah. I spent six days on a transatlantic liner with Stanton.
Super guy. Speaking of good guys, so are you. Where do you get Confessions of an Alien Hunter?
You can get that, of course, at any of the usual book sites. It comes out a week from today, so...
We're ahead of the game.
We're a little bit ahead of the game. You can order it already on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, so anybody who would like to read the book, just go there and click, and it'll come to you in a week.
All right, it's a great read. We'll come back with final phone calls with Seth Sosak right here on Coast to Coast AM. His websites are all linked up at Coast to Coast AM right now. I'm George Norrie. We will be right back. Well, a couple items for you. First of all, you can sign up still for the free Coast Zone newsletter. It's an email newsletter delivered right to your computer. Go to coasttocoastam.com. You can sign up for that. Also, if you're not a member yet of Streamlink, lots of nice little perks there. So sign up for Streamlink if you can afford pennies a day. And I guess that's all we have left nowadays with the economy, but that's still pretty good value. We'll be back with final phone calls with Seth Sosak on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Seth Sosak. Boy, that's rough to say that 10 times in a row sometimes, Seth.
My mom has trouble.
What drives you? What keeps pushing you to get these answers?
Well, I think in the end, I mean, it's curiosity. That's part of it. I think that's a large part of it, actually. We want to know about other, if you will, equals, if you want to call them that. I mean, I think that's wired into us. But there's also the fact that, you know, in the past 10, 20 years, we've learned a lot about the universe we didn't know that all seems to be pointing in the same direction. So far, we found no showstoppers to the assumption that there might be some life out there, some intelligent life out there. You know, it could have turned out that there weren't a lot of planets, and maybe Kepler will produce a showstopper, but, you know, maybe it won't. Maybe it'll just show that, yep, Earth-like worlds, there are probably a trillion planets in our galaxy, and maybe 10% of them are like the Earth. That's a lot of planet pleasure.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go. William in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, William, go ahead.
Hi, this is William from Wichita, Kansas.
Sure thing.
I worked at Boeing for a number of years, and I was subcontracting with Boeing. And I've got to experience and see certain technologies that's happened overnight, in which the public, general public, has no idea. Star Wars programs. By the way, I was seeking for a comment and then a reply, and one more comment, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, they have laser cannons, okay, and there have been tests done on like Scud missiles. Okay, where they just blew the gas tank out, so the missile never leaves its country, okay, where anywhere in the world. So that's just some of the technology they have. They have laboratories and secret facilities in which I couldn't even look over a guy's shoulder to see what was going on the computer, you know. And I was taking out systems for upgrade. And my comment is all about if he's aware of the U.S. government shooting down alien spacecraft in our atmosphere.
Well, I can answer that for you. I would say no, yeah, would be his answer.
Well, George, you just answered for me. William, I am not aware of that. Mind you, you know, the military does things that I'm sure I'm not aware of. But I've never heard any stories like this, I have to say.
These UFO reports that we hear all around this planet, Seth, do you think, man, I know people are seeing something, obviously, right, whatever they may be, but how many of them do you think could be military aircraft that we just haven't been told about?
I actually think that that's probably a fairly major component of them. I mean, major, I mean, maybe 10, 20%, something like that. There have been various stories that have come out of, for example, the former Soviet Union is reputed to have kind of encouraged UFO reports because that way, you know, people wouldn't actually recognize that they were testing military aircraft and so forth and so on. I mean, you hear these kinds of stories. I don't know how reliable they are. But, you know, it is the case. I'm thinking now of Stevensville, and I'm thinking of the Phoenix Lights and so forth, that an awful lot of these reports occur near military bases. And you can say, oh, that's because the aliens are interested in our military. You know, that's one explanation, but that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if they can come here, they don't care about our military, right? I mean, when you go and study ants in the backyard, do you worry about the fighter ants? You know, keep away from them. You study those particularly because they're dangerous? I mean, you don't. So, you know, so that's one explanation. The other possibility is that, in fact, you know, the reports are being confused by military maneuvers. I think that there's some truth in that. Let me say one more thing about actually the UFO biz, and that is this. You know, every year there really are many, many reports, tens of thousands, I think, are actually reported, and I'm sure many more sightings are made that aren't reported. And all it would take is one really good report with, you know, really good photography or with a piece of the alien craft, something you could stack up in a lab or a museum, just one. And then the whole thing is resolved. Now we know. And so to me, the fact that there are thousands of reports is actually not a good indicator that there's something, you know, from outer space that's visiting Earth. I think it's just the opposite, because in all those thousands of reports, all you need is one good example, and you change everybody's mind who's skeptical, and they haven't done that.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Let us go to Beverly, Massachusetts, east of the Rockies. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Fascinating subject here. Seth.
Yes, sir.
I have watched you on television many, many times, and I've been very curious about a lot of things. But basically, two things here. Number one, how do you know what frequencies to listen to, and how do you know alien civilizations listen to the same type of broadcast on the same type of frequency. Maybe they communicate in other ways. And number two, if you people actually got a signal that you could prove that it was real, do you think the federal government would actually allow you people to report that information to the public? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be, Mr. Cynical here or anything like that, but I think they're a legitimate question.
Right. Well, Kevin, as to your first question, how do we know what frequencies we should listen to? Because how do we know what frequencies they've chosen to broadcast on? I mean, that's a perfectly good question.
Right.
And the answer is there are two things that we consider. One, on the basis of what we know about astronomy, there's some frequencies in the microwave band, which is the band that seems to be best for communication just because of the crud that hangs between the stars. There's some areas of that where there are, if you will, natural markers, natural emitters that everybody in the universe will know about. And we think, okay, if they're really trying to get in touch, they may use one of these frequencies. It's near 1.4 gigahertz for those who care. But, you know, we are guessing. We are guessing. And that's one of the things that the Allen Telescope Array will do better, because it'll be able to cover a much, much wider swath of the radio dial. And so if we're guessing wrong, we might still trip across the signal because, you know, we're just covering more of it.
Right. So, I understand that. But, I mean, let's suppose that alien intelligent species out there don't broadcast on radio.
Well, in that case, we're not going to hear
them. Another way. That's what I'm...
Yeah. Well, that's always possible. But, you know, but since we haven't been able to think of anything better on the basis of the physics we know,
right,
you're kind of stuck. I mean, you could say, well, maybe this is wrong and just sit on your hands.
Right. Or, well, I understand. I'm just curious.
Okay, so there's that. Your second question, you know, do I think that we would be allowed to say anything? Well, we kind of know the answer to that because we've had false alarms. As I mentioned in this book, the first story is about a false alarm we had in 1997. And, you know, for all night long, we're watching this signal. I keep waiting for somebody to show up and, you know, try and shut us down or at least express a little bit of interest, right? I mean, I'm just hoping my relatives will even show up. Well, nobody showed up. But in the morning, the New York Times began to call. They already knew about it.
I know, but you see, in lieu of other UFO sightings like at Roswell and stuff and others, the government has lied so many times, and
But we're not the government. This is.
Well, I understand that, but you're not afraid that they might squelch you people.
No, I don't think so. As I said, when we thought we had a real signal, there was absolutely no interest. And do keep in mind, Kevin, that if you pick up a signal coming from some star system, that signal's up in the sky. You can't do what, for example, they did in Roswell, where they collect up the evidence and take it somewhere. Right, it's in the sky, so anybody with an antenna can go look at it again. So, you know, it's a different situation, I think, and maybe I'm being naive, but experience has not shown that this is really an issue. There doesn't seem to be any. There was absolutely no attempt to, you know, cover up any of the information. And of course, if you found a signal, you would call up somebody at another observatory somewhere else in the world and have them look at it too, because you wouldn't believe it yourself until it had been found by several groups. Because, you know, your own equipment might be faulty somehow.
That clip that I played from Contact right before you came on, Seth.
Yes.
So poignant, I think. Other aliens, other civilizations must be thinking the same way we are right now. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure that in many ways they probably are. I mean, when you ask yourself, what are the big things that you worry about? You know, these days people worry about their 401Ks. But if you sort of step back...
And they should.
Right. If you step back from that and say, what should you really worry about? You worry about short-term survival, or, you know, is the species going to survive for another 1,000 or 10,000 years? We talked a little bit about that. In the end, you worry about long-term survival because the universe is going to run down. It's you know, the suns are going to die, not just our sun, but all the stars are going to die eventually. So if you're really in there for the long haul, if you're talking about a really advanced society, they're not worried about, you know, next week's taxes or anything. They're not worried about that kind of small-scale stuff. They're thinking, how can we survive into the deep future? Is there any way to do that? Can we beat the rap that the universe really has, namely that it's going to run down? And I think, you know, any really advanced society would probably be thinking about those sorts of things. Maybe I'm wrong.
But time for a few more calls. Salem, Oregon, we go west of the Rockies. Don, thanks for holding.
Hi, guys. Real quick, Seth, my one-year-old and three-year-old granddaughter thinks you, Dr. Tyson, and Dr. Kaku are the bee's knees. You cost me a fortune in astronomy magazines and telescopes. But the questions are we looking for Earth-like planets in our galaxy? And the second one is, if we get to the Big Bang, what's on the other side? And I'll let you guys go, and thanks very much.
Okay, Don. Well, your first question's easy. Your second question is really hard. We're looking for Earth-like worlds. Kepler, for example, is, you know, the thing that was just launched this week. And it's looking at about 100,000 stars. They're all in our galaxy. They're mostly fairly nearby, within, you know, a few hundred, maybe a few thousand light years. So, you know, that's our backyard, if you will. So we're looking for Earth-like worlds in our own backyard. I mean, the point is that our backyard is probably typical of a lot of backyards. So, you know, if you say, all right, on the basis of Kepler, we know that 20% of all stars have Earth-like worlds, or whatever the number is, you can assume that that's probably true everywhere, probably everywhere in the universe. So, you know, that's the kind of number. So that answers that. On the other side of the Big Bang, I think what you're asking there is, what was there before the Big Bang? And, you know, the really intriguing thing is not so much that I can't answer that question, but that you can even ask that question. Because, you know, 10, 20 years ago, people would say, you can't ask that question, because there was no time before the Big Bang. So the word before isn't even legitimate. You can't even ask the question. But today, physicists do ask this question, and there are lots of theories. There's a guy at Princeton by the name of Steinhardt and others who are thinking very hard about whether the Big Bang isn't just sort of an accident that happened in, you know, in a higher dimensional hyperspace, if you will, where membranes collide and you get a Big Bang. And, you know, you're getting Big Bangs all the time, and we're just sort of a fender bender in a greater meta-universe. These are, you know, this is almost philosophy at this point, but there may be science behind it, and maybe within a generation we'll be able to answer the question, what was there before the Big Bang?
Let's go to Circleville, Ohio, where we have Daryl waiting for you, Seth. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, good morning. Hey. I'll make this really quick. I recently changed operating systems to Linux, and I came across a SETI Spy home monitoring tool. Does that help you guys process the information that you guys receive? Or what does it do?
Now, that's CSETI, I believe. And, yes. Seth, does that work with you at all?
No, we're not.
The computer system?
Yeah, I don't know, Daryl. Are you talking about SETI at home, or are you talking about CSETI?
SETI at home.
Yeah.
Okay.
SETI at home. Well, unfortunately, I can't help you with that, because that's not our project. That's a project of the SETI guys. There's a couple of SETI guys at the University of California at Berkeley. You know, they're on the other side of the bay, which isn't too far from us, but it's a different project, and I'm unfortunately not familiar enough with their operating scheme to help you there. I'm sorry about that, Daryl.
Okay, I was just wondering if it helped out both of you guys or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great thing to do, to process those data with SETI, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
Let's go to New York, New York. Hello, Alan.
Hi, gentlemen. I have a question for Dr. Shostak.
Sure.
The 1977 WOW signal that was picked up by the Big Air Radio Observatory, I think it was 6EQUJ5, was what they picked up. And I know that you're familiar with it, because I read something where you had mentioned that you'd be turning the Allen Array into that section of space. But my question for you is this. Do you believe that the source was extraterrestrial, number one? Two, what do you make of the signal? And three, do you think that there's any possibility that you might pick it up again? Which is a terrible question, I realize, but I'd love to hear your answer.
Yes. Well, the WOW signal, indeed, 1977. And by the way, that's 6EQUJ5 or whatever. People have written me, and they've tried to decode that. But all that was a way of encoding the strength of the signal, because in the old days, computer outputs just came on line printers, and you only had 0 to 9 for letters, and then they would, or for numbers, and then they would go to letters, A, B, C, D. So that's all that is. It's not some sort of nifty code or anything. Look, the thing about the WOW signal is it looked like it was an extraterrestrial signal, but the telescope was rigged up so that it would look at the same spot on the sky twice. So it looked once, and it saw that big signal, and then 70 seconds later, that's a little over a minute later, it looked at the same spot on the sky, and it didn't see
gone.
It. It was gone. And it has been looked at many times. Well, as you point out, we're going to do that with the Allen Telescope Array Tube, a little project with a guy in Chicago to do that. But it has never been seen again. So what's the bottom line, and what can you say, Alan? All he can say is it was seen once. Maybe it was E.T., and he broadcast once and then went out for lunch.
Maybe he was broadcasting from his craft.
Yeah, well, it's all possible. But the problem is that unless you find it more than once, right, you're not going to be able to claim it as science. It was just one of
those. No, if it's on, things. It should be on continuously,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a limitation because maybe real signals aren't always on continuously. But at this point in our development, if it isn't on long enough for lots of people to confirm it, you wouldn't believe it. So that's all you can say.
It is fascinating, though, to think of the possibilities, Seth, that you might one day get a signal of some kind of intelligence. What would it be? Would it be a code? Would it be? Would you hear audio? What would it be like?
Well, that's very speculative, but this is my thought on it, George. I think that any signal we get is going to be sort of like a two-part signal. The first part is just the signal that tells you that they're on the air.
Yeah.
We've been talking about that all night. And that's, if you will, a one-bit signal. It's just one bit of information. Hey, this spot in the sky, pay attention because we're here. Okay. Then you go back and you build this big and much bigger antenna, and then you get the message. And if they're deliberately broadcasting to you, then you can say this. They know that you're a long way away. Right, they're probably hundreds of light years, maybe 1,000 light years away. So it isn't going to be conversation. There's not enough time for that. It would take hundreds of years for the signal to get here. We answer them. That's another couple hundred years. You know, that's too tedious. So I think they're just going to send everything at once. They're going to send their internet or something like that. That's what they're going to
do. I love it. It's a great read. Conversations of an Alien Hunter with Seth Shostak. For Dave Caprita, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.